Hi, I'm Jack Harvey from the UK, listening to F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 836, June 15th. 2020. Nasser?
Thank you, sir. The hills will be alive with sound of motorsport music as we wait for the Julie Andrews Grand Prix in July. Back to Mr. Rogers of podcasting.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Bottas will stay at Mercedes. Mercedes loses their chief engine guy. Does a virtual winner really count? We got more from Gary Sloan in thepitlane.com. This week's vintage interview is an obscure driver from Formula One. His name is Mario Andretti. I also want to thank Yacht Consulting Limited in France for their donation. Send me your address and you will get une tasse de café sur moi, monsieur. And I just want to remind everybody, we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. And I thank everybody who does contribute to this wonderful, a wonderful, wonderful show. Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I am doing very good, sir. Thank you for asking. Just very, very excited, even though the lockdown is still on. But we're going to have a Grand Prix in a few weeks. How are things on the lefty coast?
Very, very good, sir. It's summertime. Oh, well, it's almost summertime. So we've got great weather as usual in California. Very similar to Spain or southern France. And we are excited. Certainly, you must have been pumped up watching all the action at the track in Miami, the Homestead NASCAR. We had the Cup Series. Boy, so exciting. And of course, all the hoopla with Bubba Wallace, your buddy, making his dealio count with Black Lives Matter. And kudos to Bubba. Nasser, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm doing very good, sir. Again, thank you. And talking of Black Lives Matter, have you seen the Willie T. Ribbs movie called Uppity?
No, sir.
Well, you know, I spent almost a decade side by side with him in the racing circles. And man, what a movie. It is done by Adam Carolla, very well done. But in all fairness, I have to say it is just his side of the story. And you and I both know there are two sides to every story. So a lot of finger pointing. And I let people, you know, who want to watch it and make their own decision. So, but life goes on, sun comes up, and, but you know, man, I used to watch all the NASCAR races, but once they start doing the stages and, you know, Mickey Mouse stuff like that, then I really lost interest. And I just cannot get excited about virtual racing. I mean, do you have any, I have nothing against it, but it does not, float my, you know, little dinghy that I have in my backyard. Are you excited about e-racing or virtual racing?
Well, let me go back to Le Dakar. I completely agree with you. By the time the weekend's over, they've had like six or seven races. And of course, I include the Xfinity Cup Series, which I have no idea why it's not NASCAR, but it is NASCAR, but it's not NASCAR. But all I know is Dale Earnhardt Jr., this will be his last races. He said he's going to give it up. He's going to hang up the keys to the car. Stunning. Now, when it comes to virtual racing, who in the world thinks this is real racing? They're sitting at their house in a comfortable chair, punching a lot of buttons. They're not moving. This is not racing, folks. I'm really disappointed with Autosport.com covering some of this virtual racing. I mean, I don't get any of it. I mean, I'm glad George Russell and people who are winning some of these races are excited about winning and the SIM card and the E to be. I know I'm old and I'm showing my age, but is this what's going to happen in the future? I mean, is it really between the blue pill and the red pill? Am I going to have to watch Matrix 4 to understand the virtual racing? So there you go. I'm done, Nasser.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So anyway, let's move on to today's podcast. And today it has a Clint Eastwood theme, Good, Bad, and the Ugly. And of course, we shall start with good news. Like we said, we have the first Formula One race of the season since December of last year. Less than 3 weeks away now, the first weekend of July at the Red Bull Ring. But wait, there's more. It's a doubleheader the following weekend at the same place. And I was talking to, our friend, F1 Weekly friend, Inam Ahmed. He will be racing in Formula 3 with Carlin in Austria. And because of all the rules and regulation, because of the virus, even his Papito could not go to the race. So we'll see how it works out. But it's good to have motor racing back soon. According to Red Bull Ringmeister, Dr. Marco, it's only Mercedes they have to fear, apart from fear itself. And when it comes to their wunderkind, Max V has no fear. And with FIA clamping down more on engine fuel tricks, as winningly displayed by the Scuderia Ferrari last season, I have to for once agree with Doctor of Jurisprudence. Now, last week, cars are in action. Mercedes were testing at Silverstone. Both Lewis and Bottas used a 2-year-old car, which is allowed by regulations. Team boss Toto said, and I quote, "For all of us racers, it's just the right atmosphere to see the car in action and hear the engines roar." End of quote. Now, nice of him to say that, but I wouldn't call the sound made by these hybrid engines a roar. They sound more like Louisiana swamp mosquitoes. Sir, are you still sticking to your prediction? It's Lewis Hamilton's championship from Austria to Abu Dhabi?
Absolutely, sir. It's going to be exciting. I really wish I knew what Alonso was thinking right now.
What is he thinking? What do you think he's thinking?
I think he's thinking that I'm thinking that a season in a camping chair is a good season.
You know, he needs to send a text message to Jeff Gillooly. You remember him?
He's my buddy.
Yes, you know, so maybe he can have some sort of a meeting with Lewis Hamilton somewhere, and then Fernando Alonso can jump into the Mercedes and win a lot of races and then say, "Ha ha, I have half the championships now of Lewis Hamilton." That's not going to happen. So we shall move on to for sale sign at Williams. As expected, three main potential bidders for the team are Michael Latifi from Canada, Dmitry Mazepin from Russia, and Chanoj Nissany from Israel. All three have sons who are Grand Prix champions in their nightly dreams, and good for them. Apparently, Papa Latifi, who has loaned a lot of money to the team with their buildings and historic collection as collateral, is on pole position to give Claire Williams pink slip, which reminds me of a line from a Diana Ross song. "Do you know where you're going to? When you look behind, there is no open door." What do you have to say about when a team is putting its buildings and historical collection as collateral to get some moolah? That says it all, huh?
Well, you know, it's like going to the pawn shop, bringing the family silverware.
Yeah, but if you bring grandma's nightgown also, then you know it's pretty much the end of the road.
And now, it's Gary Sloan.
Hello, listeners. My name is Gary Sloan, and this is this week's edition of In the Pit Lane. So, with the driver's silly season in full swing, One name has emerged as a possible Renault driver for 2021. Step forward the Chinese driver Gunyai Zhu, who currently drives in Formula 2 for the Virtuosa team. He spent 4 years in the Ferrari Driver Academy and then in 2019 switched to the Renault Sports Academy. 2020 saw him become a test driver for the Renault Formula 1 team. Now, promoting Zhu to Formula 1 may make commercial sense for Renault, as the company recently announced it would concentrate long-term on selling electric vehicles in the lucrative Chinese market. But the bigger picture is, what are the chances of a Chinese driver in a Chinese Formula 1 team? Well, last year, Adrian Campos, the ex-Spanish Formula 1 driver and former owner of the HRT team, current owner of the Formula 2 Campos Racing team, announced he and business partner Salvatore Gandolf were working on a new Formula 1 team project. Now, they face two major hurdles. One is securing an engine partner, which will only be possible after the 2022 regulation changes. The second is the age-old problem of money and the substantial sums required. So maybe Campos and Gandolf should explore the Chinese option and create a Spanish-Chinese team. A deal could be reached which would see a Chinese manufacturer enter into a Formula 1 engine program for the first time. The most likely candidate is a company called Weichai, the Chinese state-owned enterprise. Not only do they produce diesel engines, but also powertrain. Now, this would be an ambitious move to start an engine program from scratch. But it's worth noting the Chinese can work at breathtaking speed, as witnessed by the building of new hospitals in 14 days at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Weichai is no stranger to Formula 1, as the team currently sponsors the Formula 1 Ferrari team. With the prospect of a Chinese driver and engine, the second hurdle is investment. But with the 2021 budget cap and an anticipated review of the revenue share from Formula 1, there's a new reality that may favour Campos. Possible investors in the team could include China Media Capital. Now, CMC have a history with F1, as they actually tried to buy it from the previous owner CVC Capital, only to be outbid by our old friends Liberty Media. They also own the DS Technique Formula E team in partnership with the French manufacturer DS Automobiles, which is a sub-brand of Citroën. So there's a history there. Another option is a Chinese car manufacturer. Now, amongst the top four manufacturers, the FAW Group, they could use their luxury marquee Hongai, or the SAIC Motors Group could use their Roane brand. Interestingly, SAIC are owners of the MG car company, so they could use this iconic brand, but this may well be at odds with them promoting one of their own Chinese brands. Chinese car manufacturers are involved in motorsport, as we've seen with the Formula E team NIO 333, which is owned by the Chinese car maker NIO, and its Chinese driver Mai Qiu Ho, who previously made several free practice appearances in F1 during test driver stints at HRT and Caterham. Who could sponsor the team? Well, an ideal candidate to join the oil giants already involved in Formula 1, Shell, ExxonMobil, BP, Petronas, etc., would be PetroChina. The Chinese and oil gas company is actually a joint venture with Petrotinius, which is owned by Sir Jim Ratcliffe's Ineos, who of course sponsored the Mercedes Formula 1 team. Now, Liberty Media has shown considerable interest in China, stating, "We think there are opportunities in China to develop another Grand Prix," adding they wish to establish a year-round presence and a big fan base. So, could we see the possibility of a Chinese driver, engine, team and sponsor racing at not just one, but two Chinese Grand Prix? Well, it's new and strange times we live in. Finally, a twist. We should never discount the Chinese car manufacturer Geely, who could join the party, and as owners of Lotus Cars, they could reintroduce the brand back into Formula 1. Strange times indeed. My name's Gary Sloan from InThePitLane.com. Till next week, stay safe and stay well.
Gary, thank you.
Next, we move on to Mugello, closing in on becoming ninth race of the 2020 Formula 1 season. And sir, I have been once to this track, and I have to say the drive from Florence to Mugello is simply marvelous. Perfect for Senor Ricardo Montalban in his Chrysler Cordoba with Corinthian leather. It's located in the beautiful Tuscany or Toscana area of Italy, and it's owned by Ferrari, and of course it's certified as an F1 track, so they are hoping they can get some action there in September, right after the Monza race. Now, China and Portugal are on the in-and-out menu, double-double. Both these places are talking to FIA, Formula One people, that they may be able to get an approval for back-to-back races later in the season. There will be two races in Shanghai and two races in Portimão, which is located in the beautiful Algarve country of Portugal. Algarve area of Portugal, I should say. And this track, man, amazingly, this track is not designed by Herman Tilke, not that I know of, but it's a fantastic facility. Are you familiar with the layout of this track, sir?
No, sir.
If you ever get a chance or anybody interested in, of course, a lot of action available on YouTube. It is a beautiful, beautiful facility. Okay, sir, now we come on to the bad things happening. And, sir, I have sad news for you. Monterey Motorsports Reunion cancelled. Your favorite historic motorsports event at Laguna Seca has been cancelled. And now I hear the volunteers for the track have terminated their contract negotiation with the new owner of the track. I don't know what these people are trying to do, but I will not be surprised if Laguna Seca becomes Riverside International Raceway of Northern California. And that will be a very sad day and will piss me off very badly. From what I have read, looks like this was a politically motivated management move. The man in charge now has no motorsports experience. I'm not even sure if he is interested in motor racing.
Yeah, it's sort of bizarre, but to be honest with you, his background is strictly hotel management.
Yeah, you know, the area, the track is not a very long track like Spa or Nürburgring, but you know, the prime, it's prime real estate in a very affluent area of California. I will not be surprised if they tear down the track and build houses or, you know, something, golf course there, which will be very sad. It's a very, very nice track, man. You know, you've been given a ride around the track, right? I've done that a couple of times, obviously not in racing cars. But, you know, when you're going on the back stretch and the car is heading towards Corkscrew, all you see is beautiful blue sky. And then they drop on the Corkscrew. It's one of the most iconic turns and drops in all of motor racing, and it has to be preserved, you know.
I'll tell them that.
Oh, that'll be nice, sir. Okay, the next news item is also bad, but may end up in a good result. The news is Miami, the dream destination city of Mr. Chase Carey, may not be on his Expedia travel itinerary, and this may mean Mr. Penske maybe singing to Mr. Carey, welcome to back home again in Indiana. And I would absolutely, positively, before 8:30 a.m. FedEx early morning delivery, will cherish this information and confirmation. And I say just the museum visit at Indianapolis Motor Speedway is well worth it. Sir, would you like to see a Grand Prix at Indy track again?
I would. It's great. It's well organized. Like you said, the Hall of Fame at the Speedway is unreal. From European theater to the United States, it just covers everything, including the war, the World War, the second one, with unbelievable trophies from the Germans. It's just fascinating. It's a great museum. It's a great track. It's nice people. And the food and the hot dogs are out of control.
Yes, sir. The track is, you know, easy parking available. It's not far from the airport. And every time I've been there for the Grand Prix or a few times for the Indy 500, the people are very nice. And you're talking about trophies, you know, and stuff there. They have the car that won the very first Indy 500 1911. They have the car, the Ferrari, the last Ferrari to win at Le Mans 24 Hours. That car is there, driven by American driver Mastin Gregory and Jochen Rindt. That car is there. And I remember some years ago when I was going to the Grand Prix there, one of my business associates in Austria, he requested me if I could get him a picture of that car, so which we did. That's what we are at F1 Weekly Friendly Folks, you know, kind of like McDonald's. And then they also have the car, the trophy that was won by, Rudy Caracciola, when he won the Tripoli Grand Prix. Man, I was freeze frame for a few minutes when I saw that trophy for the first time. I did not even know it was there, but I could not believe that trophy was there. So it's a fantastic place. And now under the dynamic leadership and management of Mr. Roger Penske, I think this place will have a very different look sometime next year. Okay, sir, continuing with our bad news item, hard to believe this day and age there could be any bad news for Lewis Hamilton and the Mercedes F1 team. But engine chief, engine guru Andy Cowell will be leaving the team after 16 years of service, which has seen complete domination of the hybrid turbo era. Now the question is, where will he go? I wonder if Renault will use the money left behind by Daniel Ricciardo to get him to move to Viry-Châtillon, or will he embrace the spaghetti culture and enjoy some gelato in Maranello? So question for you, sir. After Andy is gone next season, he actually, I think, is leaving in July. Do you really believe it will have any effect on the winning and charming ways of your favorite driver, LCH, in 2021?
No, because I believe this gentleman has already fully designed the 2021 engine. He's been supervising it, and everything is all well. It's 2022, they should be worried. In the year 2022, LCH won't win. There you go.
There you go. Okay, media matters. A maximum of 10 media representatives will be allowed at the opening round and the behind-the-closed-door Grand Prix in Austria and Hungary when the 2020 F1 season starts. And, of course, they will give preference to, you know, like AP and Reuters, you know, major channels. And then what they will do after the first batch of 10 people have been allowed, then they will switch, you know, so nobody is complaining that they are not getting a shot. But, you know, the F1 media feed will be there, so at least I am really looking forward to watching this race. Of course, there will be no the grid parade they do. There will be no podium ceremonies. And they're going to take a lot of measures so people are, you know, separated. And I believe the press conference, the media conference they do may also be through a Zoom or whatever, Skype. It's better safe than sorry, but we really look forward to the Grand Prix. Now we come to one of our favorite, Jean Alesi. Okay, this chap has sold his Ferrari F40 for the love of his son Giuliano so he can pay for a season in Formula 2. Mr. New Motivation received this car as a gift of finally winning a Grand Prix for Scuderia Ferrari in Montreal many moons ago. And Jean said this with a lot of passion, and I quote, "In our family, we do everything with passion. Having a Ferrari F40 in the garage or seeing my son racing is no comparison. I prefer that he drives. I'm too old for the F40 anyway." End of quote. You know, the only sad part is, with all due respect to Giuliano Alesi, he is not as talented and quick as his Papito. And he has been racing for several years in European Junior Formulae and really has not shown in the Formula 2 or Formula 3. Like, you know, I am the man. So what do you think about Jean Alesi selling his car?
Sort of sad. I mean, really, Ferrari should have come in and said, we'll take care of it. Don't sell the car. Keep the car. That was a gift. We'll front you some cash. Take care of the boy. As a matter of fact, why don't we just put him in the Ferrari development program and that'll take care of the bills. I don't know. I thought that was a little bit awkward. It almost sounded like Jean Alesi was waiting for Ferrari to kick down, but they didn't. So nobody likes to sell their F40. Trust me, when you have an F40, you don't want to sell it.
Yeah, and you know, he is already in the Ferrari driver development program, FDA Academy as they call it. But this really proves that some of these drivers, actually there are several drivers who are in different programs, and I am sure it's some sort of a commercial consideration being paid by driver or his sponsors. Otherwise, you know, these top teams, they don't take. Case in point is Miss Tatiana Calderon is a development driver at Alfa Romeo and Jamie Chadwick at Williams. So there's a lot more to these deals than just pure racing talent. You know what I'm saying? But I have a very important question for you. Would you sell your Traxion Avant to sponsor your son in the Camping World Truck Series?
No.
Okay. So now we will move on to motorcycle champion on Bobby Fuller program. The Spanish taxman is after lots of pesos from the 250cc motorcycle champion Senor Sito Pons. He also owns a Moto2 team in MotoGP competition these days. The lawman or the taxman is claiming that between 2010 and 2014, Pons said he was living in Viva España, but they checked some financial records and phone records and discovered that he was living in Viva España. I'm sorry, he told them he was living in England and Monaco, and they checked his financial records and phone records and found out that he was spending a lot of time in Viva España. So now he is accused of tax evasion to the extent of 2.5 million euros, which is a lot of money. So the tax man wants to put him behind for 24 years, plus a 12 million or something like that dollar fine. The question is, where is Leona Hemsley, the queen of mean, when you need her? So I just hope F1 Weekly, with all the bucks it makes, is up to date with their tax returns.
Don't worry. You know who we use.
Of course. The Trump tax man. We're doing an audit, going through an audit, and we shall release in the year 2525. That's good. Okay. So now we go to, now we come to ugly or the sad part of today's podcast. A lot of sad news to report, unfortunately. Just an hour or so ago, I heard the news that Pauline Hailwood, widow of Mike Hailwood, has passed away. She was suffering from cancer. And Mike Hailwood, obviously a great motorcycle legend, also raced in Formula One, and he was killed in a car crash with his young daughter. He was hit by a lorry, as they call it in UK, a big truck, as we call it here. So that's pretty sad news, Pauline Hailwood passing away. And a few days ago, this is a name that I've known for years and years, longtime Porsche engineer Hans Metzger passed away at the age of 90. He was responsible for the turbo engine that McLaren used to win three drivers' championships between 1984 and 1986, one for Lauda and two for Alain Prost. He also designed the 911 engine, and his engines also had success at Le Mans. So a very important contribution he made. And he was, I think, joined Porsche in 1956. So pretty sad to see him go. Also passing away a few days ago was Canadian Grand Prix driver Epi Witsis. He made two Formula One starts at Mossport Park, which is near Toronto. And he was 82 years old. He was born in Netherlands and moved to Canada with his family at the age of 12. He was also the 1981 Trans Am champion. So condolences to families and friends. Okay, Mr. Rogers, I don't know if you read this news item today. This is under our famous last words segment. Your favorite driver, Mr. Lewis Hamilton, is also on the Bubba Wallace program, and I guess he's taking on everybody. He said on Instagram that Spanish children are being taught to torture and kill bulls. It's truly disgusting, Spain. Now, this tweet or whatever it was posting was deleted later, but he also said, we're asking Spain's Ministry of Education to close bullfighting schools immediately. Now, obviously, a lot of people in Spain, well, they were not happy with Lewis. They have not been happy with Lewis since 2007. Gee, I wonder why. But a Spanish writer and television host, Fernando Sanchez Drago, said of Hamilton, and these are his words, I quote, is not a minimum of intelligence required to obtain the racing license. End of quote. Spain is important to you. LCH is important to you. What say you on the issue, senor?
It's cultural. Bullfighting is important. It's on television every weekend in the afternoon for everyone to enjoy. Bulls love it. They get a good paycheck. It's a great career. And it keeps people off the streets. For God's sakes, leave the bullfighters alone. I mean, come on. The conquistador. El toreador. So it's exciting. So there you go. I don't know. I'm pro bullfighting. But I'm pro bull, too. I think they should live, not die. That's my tip of the week.
Now, you've lived in Spain as a kid or teenager or whatever your age was. Did you ever go to a bullfighting event?
Yes, very exciting. Ice cold beer and lots of hot dogs.
Very good, very good. There you have it, sir. So anything else you would like to discuss, Mr. Rogers?
You know, once again, I knew the historics would cancel, and I knew they would have problems with this new management, but it is what it is. I'm still driving out to Monterey on Monterey weekend for the canceled events. There's going to be something happening. You know what's going to be happening? F1 Weekly host Clark Rogers will be in Pacific Grove all weekend from August 8th through the 10th. I don't know. Check it out. The Pebble Beach dates, I'll be there in Pacific Grove with my Traction Avant. I'll be giving away free F1 Weekly stickers and signing autographs.
Well, our friend Mr. Philip Pegler is in that part of Cali, so you should hook up with him for some hot dogs and kidney pudding. Best of both worlds.
I know. He's cooking the hot dogs.
But I got to tell you, man, about Laguna Seca. My greatest racing memory after being at Monza in 1982 was shaking hands with Hermann Lang, who drove a Mercedes Grand Prix team in the 1930s. Something I never, ever, ever could even think of would happen meeting this gentleman. And then I saw Juan Manuel Fangio drive a Mercedes car there. I mean, I have a lot of great memories from that place. And that's where I met Mario Andretti for the first time in 1985. And he was super kind to me. So this place has a lot of memories for me. And if this track goes, man, I'm going to be mad as hell.
And you're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, but there's not a whole lot I can do, you know.
Sure there is. You can go protest. We can go picketing. Okay? So there's always something you can do, Nass. On the other hand, we've got racing coming pretty soon. And in Austria, there will be no competition cautions.
No, I don't think so. And I've not read the weather forecast because sometimes it rains in Austria during the race weekend. Wouldn't it be something if this was a first race was a rain-affected race?
Not only that, but it would be even more hilarious if Vettel wins the entire weekend.
You know what I'm really interested in seeing is how the pink Mercedes will do. Man, if they occupy second, silver Mercedes on row one and pink Mercedes on row two, I bet you Christian Horner and a lot of other people will be doing a lot of crying in the rain and in the sunshine.
You betcha. And who's going to be laughing?
Lewis Hamilton.
El Machismo.
Well, I got to tell you, man, if Max Verstappen does not have the package to like really rattle the cage of Lewis this year, then I think, you know, by the time we reach podcast 1000, Lewis might be 9-time world champion, or at least 8-time world champion with 100-plus Grand Prix wins. That will make you very happy, right?
Exactly, Nass. I'm bouncing off the walls right now. So anyway, there you go, Nass. Keep up the good work. The check's in the mail. How about introducing Mario Andretti?
You know, it's always great to see Mario Andretti. I see him at the, when I go to IndyCar race here in St. Petersburg or the U.S. Grand Prix, and always do a little brief chat with him. I mean, just really one of, at the end of last century, he was voted in America as the racer of the century. The guy has won everything, you know, Daytona 500, Sebring, Indy 500, and I will never forget his championship winning season. And even more was the 77 season, where he was running away from anybody, but the Lotus was not very reliable. So I hope people enjoy this interview. Again, it was recorded many years ago, but always a good chat time to chat with a racing legend like Mario Gabriel Andretti. Grazie, senor.
Highlight of the day for me was definitely to see Mario Andretti drive his 1978 World Championship winning Lotus 79. In that beautiful black and gold JPS colors, mm-hmm. And Mr. Rogers taking a lot of photographs. He put one on the webpage also. And this car makes a beautiful sound, and Mario looked like a Mario in that car. And I made a comment to him, man, I mean, you went out of the pit. He went out of the pits like he was in a race. Like like Schumacher was going to pass him just now.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy, he's a born racer, you know. It was very
no such thing as slow.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just a beautiful car. The car is 30 years old, still looks like a fairly decent competitive car.
Yeah.
Beautiful noise, and to see that helmet and all that, just very good. And I remember when I was talking to Mansell, I asked him, Mario Andretti had called him his worst teammate. So I asked Mario, if he could explain a little bit on that. And he basically said that, with Ronnie Peterson, you could sit down and talk. I mean, other teammates, plan a strategy, help each other out, develop the car or sort out the car. And he said with Mansell, he said, the way he was saying was interesting. He said he came and he just grabbed all the best engineer, best all the technicians, when there was no need to do this. And he said we never had a meeting with him. So basically what he was saying is that there was no, that he never had that team spirit.
No esprit de corps. He basically was in it for himself.
Yeah. And he said when he had a great season, everything was happy. He was very happy. But when things did not go his way in the second year, he started criticizing the same people. And on a sidebar note, I was reading an interview with Keke Rosberg, which is in one of the recent motorsport magazine. And again, we're not trying to badmouth a person, just reporting on, what different people say, reference to the environment we are in right now, talking about Mario's comment and Mansell. And Keke Rosberg was good friends with this Italian driver, Elio De Angelis, who unfortunately was killed in France in a testing in 1986. And he said that when Mansell was trying to get to Williams, he was at Lotus, so Rosberg called Elio De Angelis and said, how is this guy as a teammate? And Helio said to him, do not take this guy. This Mansell is poison.
Huh.
But he said in his time with him, he had never had a problem with Mansell. Huh. So, it really depends who you're listening to. Or what.
Yeah, a lot of it, too, depends on their what their interaction with him is.
Yeah, exactly, and what the performance level was. And then, Mario, he said something very interesting. He was talking about, somebody asked him about Marco going to Formula One. And the thing about, when I also had an opportunity to do a one-on-one interview with Mario Andretti for 10 minutes, which I was looking forward to for many years, I'll tell you, and I say this as all respect to him, I was feeling like a 15-year-old kid, and I got the impression, the passion he had, the way he was answering a question, like I was talking to another 15-year-old kid, the two 15-year-olds have just seen their first Formula One race, race. I mean, and that's what I like about when I deal with people who have love for motor racing, whether it's 3-time world champion or a kid in tennis in Seattle or, anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just the passion people have, which I enjoy very much. But anyway, going back to Marco, he said something that I had always believed in, and coming from him, he should know, and I'm not convinced that I was on the right track. He said, you cannot teach someone to go faster. He said, you can hone their skills, and with the experience, you become a better driver. And I've always had that belief that once you sit into a car, first time in your life, you bring whatever fancy word you want to use, talent, God-given talent, or, package.
Spatial ability.
Yeah, and if you're on a scale of one, basically my thing was that Ralph, you can go to any school and Rob Wilson or whatever, Racing Academy, Jim Russell. A Ralph Schumacher will never be a Michael Schumacher. You cannot train Fisichella to be a Fangio or a Massa to be a Moss.
No, ultimately, everybody's talent peaks out at a certain point.
Yeah.
All the guys in Formula One have the ability to win races and championships if they're in the right package. But some guys are just faster.
Yeah.
They just have the ability to push that car as far as it will go without taking it off the track.
Yeah. And then, some gentleman asked him, of all the races, he has won in everything.
Yeah.
He said, of all the races you have won, what is the most important victory for you? And he said that the most important win for him was his victory in 1978, the Italian Grand Prix at Monza, which gave him the championship. And this is a race where his teammate Ronnie Peterson was killed. But unfortunately, victory was snatched from him for jumping the start along with Gilles Villeneuve. They both were given a one-minute penalty. So Mario Andretti took the win, but with a one-minute penalty, he dropped back to sixth, and Niki Lauda got the win. And then I asked him for his thoughts on Colin Chapman and Enzo Ferrari, two of the people he drove for, and it just was interesting. You know, he says with Colin Chapman, I'm saying this because this is not in the interview that I did one-on-one, so I'd like to share what he said with listeners. He said with Colin Chapman and Enzo Ferrari, it was one thing. These people demanded performance now. That was all. They were not looking for any excuses. I can't find the brake pedal or what is, you know, the tires.
Like, I'm not getting to grips with this car kind of thing.
Yeah, they had no room for, I mean, they demanded performance and now. And he said with Colin Chapman, he said, I always knew that if you get on his side when he was on the uptake, then, you know, sky was the limit. That, you know, once his whatever package he or, you know, technology he was trying to embrace and incorporate into his car, if it worked out, then nobody's going to catch you.
Right.
And it, what happened, in, that's what happened in 78. But the things they tried in 79, he could not even get into it. It was a hard time getting into the top five. So it was very nice to hear from the man, you know. And then somebody asked him, when you went to Monza and put the car on pole in 1982, that was my first race that I went to. He said, how did that deal come about? Who called you? And he says, you know, Mr. Ferrari called me himself. Can you imagine? A racing driver cannot get a better compliment than Enzo Ferrari calling you.
Exactly.
Would you like to drive my car?
Exactly.
Yeah, and just to hear it from the man himself, it's just like a very incredible. And I told Mario, man, hey, I was there as a young kid. I'm 23 years old, and living in beautiful Karachi in those days. And I will never forget. I mean, I knew his history then also, that he was born in Italy for all practical purposes. He's an Italian man, then he came here. And for me to be there, you know, and this on Saturday, the commentator, there used to be an English guy, I think his name was Marsh, Anthony Marsh, or Anthony Marsh, I believe was the name, with that very heavy voice. Like, you know, same guy now goes to all the races, Bob Constanduras, mm-hmm. and he had a very heavy voice. And, of course, the Italian announcer, when they were saying that on pole position, Mario Andretti of the United States, I mean, it was just unbelievable chills I had. I mean, just to, you know, it's just the... It's just what it took for him, you know, to come here, to do what he did here, went through, you know, whatever he had to go through, and to go back there, win the championship, come back to the U.S., and then get a phone call, hey, come and drive my car,
yeah,
and then put the car on pole position. Like, man, I mean, I have chills right now, as you can see. That was just a fabulous, fabulous conversation. And I met his PR assistant also. And, you know, it's hard to get 20 minutes from people like him. So, and by the way, if I may share a personal thing, before I came to the U.S., I used to write to a lot of racing people in this country, and there were two or three people who corresponded with me on a fairly regular basis. Mario Andretti was one of them.
Mm.
So I have a connection with him going back 20-plus years. And the thing I really want to see is the trophy he got for winning the Italian Grand Prix in 77 and what he got for getting the pole. Because, you know, like you said, Monza is my favorite track. It's also my favorite track. So what I'm trying to do now is, I'm not going to bug him at every race, but maybe every 3-4 months, if I'm at a race, I'll ask his assistant if I can get 5-6 minutes. And every time, get in like 5-8 questions, and then after 3-4, you know, we'll have a one-hour
interview
session.
In 8 increments.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man, I mean, you talk about a man with a passion for motor racing and all those achievements. And now, you know, we're going to play that interview, and Mr. David Tapia, our illustrious producer, was asking me to write an intro for Mario. I mean, the intro for Mario is the name, Mario Andretti.
Well, yeah, but knowing that, but to list his accomplishments is a complete segment for motorsports memories.
Yeah, you know, he was IndyCar champion in his rookie year. I mean, the guy has won Daytona 500, Sebring, and just like about anything. And, of course, any of his competitors, when you talk to them, probably if you ask AJ or Bobby Unser or anybody who was the toughest hombre, this is one of the if it's not the first name, it's definitely the second name. And all those people in Formula One who race against him, that name comes up. Yeah. I mean, you know, the name has been used in songs a few times. So it's just, I was very, very happy to be able to sit down and talk to him face to face.
So let's do that interview right now.
Grazie.
Okay, Mario, 30 years ago you won the world championship. Today you're driving that car. What kind of memories came racing back?
Oh, all of the good memories that I have with it. Every time I sit in a cockpit, it's the third time now in the last few years In this car, it just, you know, it's my element, and it's easy to sort of start, you know, just enjoying what I've enjoyed in the past. And it's a great opportunity, especially right here at Laguna Seca. You know, this is one great venue for me, you know, with wonderful memories besides, and a great racetrack. You know, this is actually the first time that I drove a Formula One. I can say I drove a Formula One car around Laguna Seca as well.
In 1977, you won two important Formula One races, one at Monza, land of your birth, and the other in Long Beach, land that gave you comfort, fame, and fortune. And in both races, Ferrari was second, Niki Lauda. Which race meant more to you, which victory meant more to you at the time?
Well, at the time, each one was equally important. However, when I reflect back now, I think from a standpoint of just my own private pride and overall feeling of fulfillment, it was Monza, you know, because that's where I saw my very first Formula One race when I was very young, and that's probably one of the races that cemented my decision to just pursue this career.
Is there anything you remember from that race?
I remember just about everything, and all I know is that I was rooting for my idol Alberto Ascari, who had a very tough day against the Mercedes of Fangio Moss, but he showed so much heart, and actually I was so excited because I knew that he was in an inferior car, yet he was still driving 103%, and that was something to watch.
Well, that's the heart and passion. I remember you from your days in Formula One. Marco, in Formula One, there's a lot of talk, a lot of hope. Would you recommend for him or any young aspiring American driver to do a season of two in GP2 or Formula 3 before getting into the Piranha pool, that is Formula Uno?
Well, I don't think there's a set formula, you know. Number one, right now, Marco is in a maximum formula here. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, it's not a good training for Formula One. Except that once you have a feel for powerful racing cars and so on and so forth and the top competition, if you go to another discipline like, say, Formula One, and the team really embraces you, and they give you the opportunity to really, before the season, the following season starts, to really get familiar and confident in the car. It would be better to have a season and knowing the circuits. But you know something? That is not necessary and totally, the thing that's required. Because historically, you have, look at Hamilton, for instance. You know, he's never been to, last year he was never at Montreal. First time ever, and you cannot test in Montreal. So he first saw the circuit, you know, through a video game probably first, and then through the eyes of a racing car when there was time to go official practice. He won the race. Why? Because he had the full confidence of the car, and any good racing driver will learn the circuit quickly. And I think he's at the stage that he could go directly to a team and just start the real thing.
Will he listen to you or Papa when it comes to going to Formula One?
Well, I think he better listen to me when it comes to Formula One, I think. And I think he probably does. I mean, he has his own way of expressing himself, and it should be. But at the same time, I think deep down, he for sure has this as the ultimate goal in his career. And now it's all about having the opportunity. You know, he has to put together some really good results and really continue to impress, you know, before somebody would be interested, in looking at him for Formula One.
Your last season, full season in Formula One, was with Alfa Romeo, a magical name in motor racing. That's where Signor Ferrari started. Did you work with Carlo Chitti, and how was that experience?
Well, I did work, of course. Carlo Chitti was the chief engineer and team manager and everything. And you know, I had driven sports prototypes for them as well. The biggest problem that I encountered in the 1980 season was that they didn't really read the rules properly, you know, and it was very gray area. And everybody was somewhat cheating, you know, with the hydraulic systems, you know, and, you know, you had a box that you had to clear on the way out of the pits. But then all of a sudden you released the hydraulics and the car dropped 4 inches in ride height, you know, so, and Alfa Romeo thought that that was cheating, so they didn't want to do it. But we suffered tremendously because the car, I think, was capable of really being very competitive. And because of that, it was a very frustrating year for me, and a year that one of the years in my career that I certainly want to forget.
In Formula One, what is your favorite track apart from Monza Autodromo?
Well, I had many tracks that I just love tremendously. I mean, Kyalami was a good track for me. You know, the ones that I really enjoyed, but it's wherever I could win. You know, I had a policy with me that I would never say this is favorite, this is not, because then your mindset would be wrong. To me, I treated them all as my favorite, but obviously, the memories of a win are always the positive memories, and those are the ones that I consider, you know, the ones that I enjoy the most.
You raced in Formula One against some of the greatest names in the sport, making your debut on pole position in 1968. Give me the two toughest drivers you raced against in Formula One, please.
I don't think I could really single it out to just two toughest drivers. Each era has the individual that's a yardstick, and I remember for me it was very, very meaningful when I did my very first, you know, stint in Formula One, even part-time in 68 when I put the car on pole and Jackie Stewart finished second. And he was the man in those days. And then when I won my very first Formula One race in South Africa, Jackie Stewart was second. And then I won the next non-championship race in Ontario. There were two 100-mile races. I won both, and Jackie Stewart was second in both times. And that told me something, gave me a lot of confidence that, you know what, this day I beat the best. And so I think I like to think I have a future here, you know, with a proper team, proper equipment. And it was very important. And you know, other times in the United States it was A.J. Foyt, and there was the answers. It was, you know, but in Formula One, again, I can look back, it could be James Hunt, could be, you know, and Niki Lauda, could be, you know, many individuals that I, you know, even don't come to mind at the moment, you know. But like you said, I was fortunate enough to race with the very best of the different eras. And that is something that I treasure.
Talking of James Hunt, do you remember what happened at Dutch Grand Prix 1977?
I remember that very well. In fact, that's he and I had a big disagreement over that, because I think I made a good pass on him on the outside, and he never expected me to do that, because that's not usually the way the passes are done in Formula One, and he ran right over my wheels. He just totally ignored the fact that I was there, and then he says I wasn't supposed to be there. I said, well, I think you got it wrong, my friend. You know, as long as the tarmac, you know, somebody's going to be there, and you have to respect that. And we had a disagreement over that, of course.
Finally, how about a message to listeners of F1 Weekly? We have a worldwide audience, and I'm sure everybody would love to hear from you.
Well, you know, Formula One is my ultimate love. It always will be. And you know, it's wonderful. To me, it's heartwarming to see so many fans that follow Formula One. And I think the experts, so-called experts, do underestimate how much love, how much of a following there is in Formula One in the United States. And I'd just love to see that increase by having an America to root for. And I hope our boy Marco is the one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mario, for speaking with F1 Weekly.
I want to thank everybody who listens. Good night.
Bye-bye.